Welcome to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Robert Kolb, co-author of Corporate Boards, Managers of Risk, Sources of Risk. On behalf of the entire Strategy Driven team, I would like to welcome you to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Robert Kolb, co-author of Corporate Boards, Managers of Risk, Sources of Risk. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag articles found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. In this special edition podcast, Robert Kolb shares with us his insights on the motivations, conflicts, limitations, roles, and ethics of corporate boards, answering the often asked question of why boards and their members behave the way they do. And so now, without any further delay, let's get started. We are privileged to be joined by Bob Kolb, co-author of Corporate Boards, Managers of Risk, Sources of Risk. Bob holds PhDs from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in philosophy and finance, and has taught at the University of Florida, Emory University, the University of Miami, the University of Colorado, and Loyola University Chicago, where he currently serves as professor of finance and holds the Frank W. Considine Chair of Applied Ethics. Bob is the author or co-author of more than 50 research articles and 25 finance texts on topics including financial derivatives, investments, corporate finance, and financial institutions. Bob recently edited the Encyclopedia of Business, Society, and Ethics. He also founded Kolb Publishing, which published finance and economics university texts and was acquired by Blackwell Publishing, now part of John Wiley & Sons. Bob, welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast.
Well, good. Thanks for having me, Nathan.
I am thrilled to have you on the show. You know, corporate boards so often appear to be that black box that everyone knows exists, but have really no insight to or no understanding of how they work. And I was fascinated by your book, Corporate Boards, because now I felt like I had some view as to what made these organizations or this part of an organization actually tick.
Right. Well, you know, I work with our Center for Integrated Risk Management and Corporate Governance, and so that's kind of a natural pairing between governance and risk management. And one of the responsibilities of corporate boards is to be the ultimate managers of risk for the firm.
Yes.
And of course, that's come to increased prominence in the last 10 years with the scandals of the early 2000s, and also now with the debacle of the financial crisis. People are wondering, where were the boards? What were they doing? Why weren't they fulfilling their function?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great segue into the first question, because as I read Corporate Boards, you started out with a discussion of the relationship between the board of directors and then the risk management organization that the company has. And in that discussion, you mentioned the board's role in managing downside risk. And I think a lot of us think of the board as managers of downside risk. What I wanted to ask was, what's the board's role in managing upside risk?
Well, I think for any corporation, the upside risk, it really is another term for strategy toward opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, in fact, the way firms make money for their shareholders. is by seeking out and exploiting good investment opportunities. So not only are they responsible for the risk management function, but they're also ultimately responsible for guiding the investment strategy of the firm, or at least in delegating that task to managers that they supervise, such as the CEO.
Right. And again, when I read your book, that just hit me right up front. It's like, well, of course that they would have to do things like that, but I just never thought of it that way. I'd always just envisioned them as, you know, the managers or the overseers of downside risk to protect the shareholders from huge losses, and not as having an active role in helping on that strategy and that upside.
Right, because, you know, a new investment project, well, let's think of BP drilling a deep water well in the Gulf of Mexico. Obviously, it has downside risk, but it also has upside opportunity or upside risk. I don't know why we say opportunity on the upside instead of risk, because it's really the same thing.
It really is. And now, talking about the board and their independence, which is so critical to managing risk and so often, I often see the chief executive of a company not only sitting on the board, but actually serving as the chairman of the board of directors. And to me, it strikes me as not necessarily being a conflict of interest, but certainly being an impairment to the board's independence, that their view is somehow maybe now skewed in the direction of what the executive team might have, because here you have the CEO heading the board. Do you see companies considering that as an impairment? And if so, what are they doing to try to eliminate or at least mitigate that potential conflict?
Well, these days is a very strong movement away from having the CEO serve as chairman of the board. This is called duality, when the same individual holds both positions because of that that very issue. And I think there's been a great concern that the boards are often captured, or at least some people think they're captured, by the CEO, in that the CEO ends up having so much control over the membership and actually the behavior of the board that they become sort of a lapdog to the CEO rather than being able to fulfill their oversight function.
When I think of that, while I have always thought of, you know, some of these individuals as being great CEOs, I also think of them as being great CEOs because they have very, I'll call them powerful personalities. And so I think of like Jack Welch, and I think, wow, he was the chairman of the board and CEO of GE. And wow, that company was so shaped in the image he wanted it to be shaped in.
Right. Well, it can be a happy outcome, but I think a lot of people fear that that's not generally the case.
And of course, GE now, under Jeffrey Immelt, who has the same role, I don't perceive them as being as successful as what they were under Jack Welch, their previous CEO and chairman.
Right. I guess there are a lot of reasons that could be. Maybe Welch didn't leave GE set up for the future as well as he could have. Maybe Immelt is not as good a manager. Or maybe just the external conditions are not favorable. I don't really have an opinion on which of those three might be the operative.
Well, Bob, there was another topic you spoke of in corporate boards, and it's one that I could really appreciate and relate to in my work with the nuclear industry. And that is, I appreciate the fact that an oversight organization must have accurate and unbiased information if they're going to perform their jobs in an effective manner. And while I'm not suggesting that people are intentionally biasing information, we all have our biases and the way we perceive and see things. And so through your book, I came to recognize, wow, boards are serving an oversight role, but the information they're getting is coming from those that they are overseeing. And again, it appeared to be some degradation to the independence of the board because they were relying on the information coming from those they're overseeing. or I guess in the worst case, potentially a conflict of interest. I was wondering how you saw that conflict playing out, and if there were anything that boards or companies were doing to try to mitigate, again, the risk that the board wasn't getting the kind of information they needed to be effective in their oversight role.
Right. Well, if you think about the formal structure of a corporation, we have the board of directors at the top, mm-hmm. the CEO reports to the board of directors, and then all the regular employees of the firm report to the CEO. So it's really not at all unusual for managers to receive information from those they supervise. I mean, that happens in every walk of life, from a corporation to the military to a mm-hmm. university and so on. But there is a problem related to this in the corporation, in that the CEO occupies such a pivotal role of power and information that in some cases the information the board receives gets filtered through the CEO. So that, I think that's the conflict that's really potentially problematic.
Okay.
Is that the board is supposed to be supervising the CEO, but the CEO, in many cases, really controls the information flow to the board. Right? So it's not so much the conflict of the board getting information from its supervisees, but that there's a mediation of that information. So people are well aware of this, of course, mm-hmm. and there are strong measures these days to try and circumvent that problem. And in particular, in the risk management field, it's common now for the chief risk officers of a corporation to report directly to the board, i.e., they don't report to the CEO, but instead they are outside the CEO's direct purview and report to the board in an effort to make sure that the board is receiving the information that they need in order to supervise the CEO.
Bob, how far does that independence go? I mean, does the board then set the compensation rate for, say, that director of corporate risk management or that organization, or do they still have some ties in, at least from a compensation area, with the CEO or other corporate executives?
I think this is an area that's very much in flux now.
Okay.
Strong movement to have a chief information officer who's at the C-level in the corporation, the executive level, and to have that degree of independence. And I think what you'll find in practice is that it's really a kind of all over the map, from very strong independence to not too much independence at all. And I think one of the measures of good governance these days is tied to that independence of the risk reporting function directly to the board.
Okay. Now, you had discussed another concept that I just found truly fascinating. In fact, I read over it a couple of times when I was reading corporate boards. And that was this concept of time inconsistent misconduct. I was hoping you could explain what time inconsistent misconduct is for our audience and then provide an example of how it occurs.
Right. Well, you know, this is a fancy name, but really the phenomenon is actually pretty simple, and I'm afraid it's one we're all too familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
the idea of the time inconsistency is the difference between the overarching goal that one has and the way in which one behaves more immediately. So, for example, I'd like to be a world-class athlete, to be in absolutely top condition and be able to perform admirably in all my sporting endeavors. That's my long-range goal.
Yes.
But on the other hand, today I'm eating donuts. So there's a time inconsistency in that simple case where in the short run I'm behaving in a way that's perhaps gratifying, but that frustrates my overall goal. So my behavior is inconsistent today with the overarching goal that I have. And the same thing happens in corporations.
Mm-hmm.
You've already introduced the topic of a conflict between the CEO and the board. Well, one of the things the board is supposed to do is it's supposed to be giving tough guidance or tough love to the CEOs. But sometimes that's difficult to do, and I think probably we all encounter situations in which we'd like to avoid conflict, and we perhaps choose to avoid conflict today in a way that leads to problems further down the road. And so that's kind of the basic idea in this time inconsistency for boards, is that board members, like all humans, sometimes give undue emphasis to the immediate comfort of behaving in a certain way to the peril of the larger strategic goal.
Yes, and I can actually say, or honestly say, that I see that all the time. It's not even I see it as a board issue alone. I see it in the way managers' performance, or they behave to achieve their own performance metrics. And, hey, we want to have a good financial quarter. So they'll behave in one way, and they'll get a great number for the financial quarter, and then now they've doomed themselves or severely penalized themselves and their organization for any good performance in the next quarter.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this idea in part comes out of neoclassical economics, or at least the reaction to it, mm-hmm. and more particularly with the development of behavioral economics and finance. In that, in the classical model, we tend to think of economic actors as rational agents who are always calculating their best behavior and taking the optimal strategy. But of course, we know people don't really behave that way. I mean, we see it in our own lives, and we see it in the lives of all those around us. And so this time inconsistency is just one of these many gaps between ideal behavior and the real world.
And appears to manifest itself in other areas. I was fascinated by the next discussion topic in your book, where you talk about risk-taking with regard to mergers and acquisitions, and how the compensation provided to the executives who conduct these mergers and or acquisitions might actually encourage them to do so, and actually encourage them to take on more risk than what is actually desired. I was wondering if you could explain how those mechanisms are at play within the organization, and what actions boards are taking to try to mitigate this risk that's created.
Right. Well, this is actually a sprawling topic. If you think about a merger, there are two parties, two firms, mm-hmm. each of which has a CEO, each of which has a board, and there are all kinds of conflicts on both sides. For instance, let's think about the target. The target CEO may want to avoid a merger in fear of losing his or her job upon completion of the merger. I mean, that so often happens. So the CEO may have a very strong incentive to act in a way that frustrates the goals of the shareholders in order to preserve his or her own position. And the same thing is really true for the board of the target firm as well. So that person is conflicted, and it's tied very closely to their wealth ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
From the side of the acquirer, the acquiring CEO has a variety of potential conflicts. And this is, in fact, well studied, with lots of different conclusions coming out of it. One issue is that sometimes firms acquire others to enlarge the scope of the CEO's ambition. So, for instance, a firm, if you double the size of your firm, well, now suddenly you're the CEO of a firm that's twice as big as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly more prestigious at the very least. But also, being a CEO of a larger corporation may translate directly into a higher level of compensation as well. So this can give the CEO a reason to engage in mergers that aren't really beneficial to the firm, just to expand his own or her own purview there.
Sure.
And similarly with the board as well. But there are further issues too. So, for instance, sometimes firms undertake mergers in order to avoid being taken over themselves. So, for instance, a firm with a large cash hoard might become a acquisition target. But if they dissipate that cash by buying another firm, particularly dissipated by unwisely buying another firm, then they remove themselves from being a takeover target because they're just not as attractive. And so that's an incentive that the CEO and board of an acquirer have to engage in poor behavior as well. And then finally, let me just mention one more thing, and that is that sometimes it seems that in these takeovers, the acquiring firm more or less buys off the CEO of the target firm by giving a certain kind of payoff in the merger process. And, of course, the reason that sometimes occurs is because the acquiring firm wants to mitigate or neuter the potential opposition of the target CEO.
Okay.
So they more or less just buy off the target CEO to get his or her acquiescence in the merger.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a whole bunch of conflicts. I haven't mentioned all of them. I'll just mention the ones that spring to mind at the moment that arise in the merger process.
Sure, but it's fascinating, the very complex dynamics that are all in play when such a merger happens. And, of course, you don't always read about all those things either, just in the front page of the, or, you know, on the headlines.
Right. Well, some are subtle, and but, you know, there's a tremendous amount of ongoing research in this area that's bringing new things to light all the time. And also, it's by no means clear that all the research reaches the same conclusion. It's very much an evolving problem.
Okay. Well, one thing I do know for sure, because we've experienced it here in Atlanta, where I'm from, is that people are absolutely infuriated when they see an executive, particularly a CEO, that has led the company, but led the company into what would be considered a failure at worst, or simply a zero growth or the like at best. And then they leave with a big package. And why I mention Atlanta, of course, I'm thinking of Bob Nardelli and his $25 million package he got when he left Home Depot, that many felt was an organization that was in far worse shape, whether we talk about financially or even within the organization culturally, when he left than when he came as a celebrated celebrity CEO, having previously worked at GE. And then I hear a lot of folks talk about the board is really responsible for these kind of compensation packages and setting up these arrangements and bringing these kinds of CEOs in. Are there any things that the boards are now doing to make sure that there's not these big payouts for executives that have maybe in a harsh term failed, but certainly have not performed up to expectation?
That's a very controversial question, really.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up a little bit. You know, when you think about a corporation, in the formal structure, the CEO reports to the board. But we've already talked about this idea of board capture, that being when the CEO comes to have dominance over the board.
Yes.
And, of course, if the CEO really dominates the board, either by the force of his or her personality, or even more explicitly by having too much say in the selection of board members and how long the board members stay on the board, well, then, in effect, the CEO could be coming to set his or her own pay.
Mm.
And, in fact, there's a very influential research stream led by Lucian Bebchuk and his co-author Fried that really talks about that, and it says essentially that in effect, CEOs and major corporations wind up setting their own pay through their dominance over the board. So really, that's the failure of corporate structure when that happens, that being the dominance of the CEO over the board. The authority is really supposed to run the other way. Now, of course, you don't want to antagonism between the board and the CEO. I mean, it's supposed to be a team.
Right.
So it's, but it's not just a team. There's also authority structures there as well. But I do find it also a little surprising that people get so emotional about this question of executive compensation in general. People who have no particular stake in these payouts become extremely emotional about it in a way I think is a little hard to understand. But it's not completely hard to understand, of course, because some of these payouts do seem so enormous. And if you take a case like in Nardelli, where I think he said he came from GE to Home Depot, and let's say that he actually did fail at Home Depot, and there's certainly a strong case to be made for that. I found it surprising that when he was ousted from Home Depot, he very quickly found another firm to lead. He became CEO at Chrysler.
Right.
And in that sense, you think, oh, well, he was making so much money, he was so overpaid at Home Depot, especially given his results. Yet in another sense, he immediately passed a market test by getting a similar position at another firm of similar size. So it's hard to make out all of this. You think, well, CEOs can't possibly be worth so much, yet when they actually have an experience like Nardelli's or Home Depot, and then go out and are immediately or almost immediately hired by another similar firm, that's enough to give one pause, or at least it should.
Mm-hmm. I even see that in my line of work at lower levels of organizations, where I'll see vice presidents or even some plant managers and the like at a further lower level, where by maybe a reasonable accounting of performance of their organization, they have not performed well and were actually let go for that performance by the organization that they belong to first, only to pop up a few weeks later at another organization at an equal or higher level, since these are not CEOs, that they sometimes actually get promoted going into another organization. And I'll admit I've never understood that. I'm simply observing its occurrence.
Right. Well, it makes you wonder if possibly the managerial talent is so rare that someone like Nardelli can somehow go ahead and meet that market test. I think it is, to some extent, inexplicable. It's as if Chrysler is saying, gee, Bob, we like so much what you did for Home Depot. Come on over and do it for us. And it seems that perhaps he has done that now.
Yeah, I guess my spin on it was maybe whoever at Chrysler was, in this case, making that determination said, well, he may not have been as successful as folks would have liked at Home Depot, but they needed a CEO with these kind of characteristics that was not him. We need a CEO with the types of characteristics that is him. Home Depot being, you know, at the time, and I think what it's gone back to, a much more family-run type organization as a cultural feel. And, you know, maybe Chrysler is more like GE, where it's more rigorous and hierarchical and process-driven rather than that family culture. And maybe Chrysler said, well, hey, we need someone with that kind of background. And the reason Bob wasn't successful over at Home Depot was he was a bad fit, and so we're willing to overlook that.
Right. Well, yeah, it's hard to know in any particular case. But if you think about a CEO and the salaries, you can think of instances where the CEO certainly appears to be earning his keep.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of Steve Jobs at Apple, for instance. I mean, when you read about the role he plays in that firm in product development and wealth creation, well, then you say, okay, sometimes perhaps CEOs really are worth the amounts that they receive. Yet there are so many instances where you look at how much money they receive and seemingly do a very poor job, and you do just have to shake your head.
Right, right. Well, Bob, for my last question, I did want to ask you for your perspective on who the board of directors should serve. If they are there for sole service of the shareholders, or if they have, I'll call it an ethical imperative, that they should serve not just the interests of the shareholders, but really the broader stakeholders of the company, whether that would be employees, could be the environment, society in general. who do you see, or what groups do you see, the board as really ultimately serving?
Right. Well, as you pointed out, I'm a business ethicist as well as a finance person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably no question that's more controversial than the role of the corporation and the conflict between shareholders as the ultimate driver, the ultimate focus, and stakeholders more broadly. But I believe that the shareholders are the owners of the corporation, and the board should serve the shareholders by seeking to maximize shareholder value, subject to certain kinds of constraints. And if things are working properly, as I believe they are in general, then the pursuit of shareholder wealth within the framework of a society really mitigates a lot of the conflicts between shareholders and other stakeholders. And let me explain a little bit about what I mean.
Okay.
Corporations are creatures of society. There is no corporation unless there's a government, because it is a government that grants charters to corporations. So focusing on that makes it explicit, I think, that corporations receive their marching orders from society, and the society really tells them how they're expected to behave. And so I view society as giving a framework to corporations, and within that framework, they should pursue shareholder interests. And that framework that society provides consists of laws about how corporations should behave. But beyond that, there are also mores in the society and unspoken compacts that are to be governed. So, for instance, if you think about the way to treat employees, well, I know in having my own company that I felt I owned the entire company, all the shares, but I often felt, in a way, I was kind of so dependent on my employees that I had to treat them well in order to make the company succeed. And so I think really, in the broader context of society, there isn't really so much conflict all the time between these various stakeholders, and that the board has an obligation to pursue the interests of the shareholders, but society is providing the framework under which that pursuit of shareholder wealth should take place.
Certainly. Well, Bob, I want to thank you for taking not just time today, but also for sharing with us your insights on why corporate boards and their members behave in the way that they do. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I thoroughly enjoyed your book and just found it to be an absolutely fascinating window into a part of the business world that to me was often this black box, fully hidden from view. I appreciated how you took some very complex concepts and conveyed them in a way that was not only easy for me as a reader to understand, but actually kept me wanting to come back to learn more. So I highly recommend Corporate Boards to all our listeners. I hope they'll pick up a copy, because I do think it's important for executives and managers to fully understand the motivations, the conflicts, the limitations, the roles, and the ethical challenges that their board of directors has. So I want to thank you again for joining us.
Okay, good. Thank you for having me, Nathan.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast. I would like to personally thank Robert Kolb for being with us today and sharing his insights on why boards and their members behave the way they do. As always, we would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. Until next time, so long.